or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of November 29th, 2015. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Information Week and your host for this week's episode of Information Week Live. We have a great show on tap in what is, as we all know, a rather somber week here in North America because of what went on yesterday San Bernardino, California. Talking with me about other things, although some of it is going to be related, we have two frequent and welcomed guests here on Information Week Live. First up, we have Sarah Peters, Senior Editor at Dark Reading. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Kurt. Always a pleasure.
And we also have Larry Loeb, contributor to Information Week, General Gadabout, and Reconteur. Larry, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, thank you. I'd like to reconte, but I don't know where my tours are.
Well, we'll see if they can be found sometime during the course of the show. And we want to dive right in because, you know, yesterday we did have this horrible shooting out in San Bernardino, now that I've remembered the name of the place. And, Sarah, I want to turn to you because the thing that I kept hearing in the coverage were people saying, this is why we need the NSA to be able to scarf up every bit of data on everyone in the country doing everything. What kind of impact do you think this is going to have on the whole discussion about mass gathering of data and the specific thing that's being discussed, metadata? Sarah, you first, and Larry, I heard that groan. I promise we'll get to you right after Sarah.
Well, every time something like this happens, I wonder which, you know, how much the pendulum is going to swing. But I don't think that it will change things quite as much as you might think. Because what people tend to be arguing for, what law enforcement and the intelligence community tends to lobby for at times like this is things like encryption backdoors. They don't want anybody to be able to hide what they're doing. And you can certainly understand the argument for that, because once you encrypt something, really, it's just about impossible to be able to recover it. And so that makes it much easier for the bad guys to hide what they're doing, and much more difficult, first of all, to find them and identify them, and then also harder to prove what it is that they're doing. And this has been an argument that's been surfacing along the way, particularly where it comes to people searching for child pornography, and then it's come up a lot again as far as surveillance goes with fighting against terrorism. But one of the there's a lot of problems with the issue of putting an encryption backdoor into the technology that only law enforcement and the government would have access to. The first one is just a kind of moral and congressional the argument that it is an uncongressional thing, because it kind of conflicts with the Fourth Amendment rights, and the Fourth Amendment protects citizens against unreasonable searches and seizures. And as somebody that I interviewed recently at a Black Hat, he said something that really stuck with me, that the Fourth Amendment was created to protect the citizens from their government, not the other way around. So the fact that law enforcement and the intelligence community has kind of said, hey, this would make our jobs a lot easier doesn't really ring true for him. And he's a guy who actually has worked in law enforcement himself before. So it was pretty powerful coming from him. The other thing is that once you put that back door in, the software becomes less secure for everybody. You're essentially putting a vulnerability into encryption software. So you've put something in there that the bad guys might be able to exploit. And we know that they are capable of breaching government systems. We know this. This is something that they've managed to do before. So it's certainly not without, you know, outside the realm of possibilities that this is the kind of thing that could be found and could be exploited for nefarious purposes. And in that case, it would not just be, you know, anything that's encrypted with any kind of encryption technology by anybody would be therefore at risk. The other thing is that it could be difficult for American businesses, because if you go around telling people overseas, hey, if they get the idea that the U.S. government will have access to everything that Americans do and that American businesses do, and they have this access to whatever we encrypt, then nobody is going to want their information and their data to have any contact with us whatsoever. The United Nations has already come out with a report this spring, I think it was, that encryption backdoors violate human rights. And even a bipartisan federal committee in May came out against this idea. So it's not just a liberal agenda. This is people on both sides really are not buying this. There's also, in addition to the backdoor thing, another idea is holding some encryption keys in escrow so that if there was something that somebody that they really wanted to look at, they could, you know, acquire a warrant. All of this is, you know, they want to put the procedures there in, so that, you know, you can't just look at anybody's stuff, that there would be some kind of proper legal procedure for acquiring the key. But the problem with holding keys in escrow is that it complicates the process of digital signatures, because of course cryptography is not just used for encrypting files, it's also used for digital signatures. And the whole point of a digital signature is to say, I've signed this with my unique signature, so it is me. I'm saying this, I've put my stamp on it, and you can guarantee that I am the one who is providing, you know, that this was me who signed this and sent it off. The moment that you say, actually, there's another copy of this, you've kind of decreased the sanctity of that signature, because there's another one lurking around that you don't have access to. I think it was at RSA, the Assistant Attorney General for National Security said something, John Carlin, he said, because this came up in conversation, he kind of an optimistic viewpoint. He's like, you know, this is a complex issue, but there's a lot of smart people talking about it, and I'm sure that if we try, we can come up with some solution. But thus far, there hasn't been a solution raised that anybody can really get behind. The law enforcement has not found a lot of support from anywhere. Whether all of these shootings will, whether that will change it, I don't know, but I don't think it will make as much of an impact as you would think, at least not as quickly as one might think.
Okay. A good, solid answer there from Sarah. And Larry, I heard your growl at the beginning, And I'd love to get your take. Do you think that people are going to try to make this a bigger deal than Sarah seems to think it will be?
It's come out in the last 24 hours that the shooter, male shooter, had on Facebook pledged allegiance to ISIL. That didn't require any encryption to decipher. That didn't require anything but reading publicly available documents. Just like in Paris, they evidently coordinated some of their attacks not with a PlayStation 4, as was originally thought, but with a plain old SMS text message. This theme has been repeatedly coming up during my association with Information Week, and I even wrote an article just yesterday about the Signal messaging app, which uses end-to-end decryption in order to function. Once someone tries to game the system, as Sarah said, digital life becomes extremely dangerous. It's also come to light in the last week that some Alabama cops have been routinely planting evidence to help them solve crimes, it seems. What's to prevent someone that wants to get me in their Kafkaesque manner to just plant a digital signature of mine should that be compromised? We've been through this debate before during the first Clinton administration anyway, with the Clipper chip and escrow fees and all that. This is not something that's just come out of thin air, although some of the millennials may not have been here for that one. It's vexing because there are some good societal needs to track down bad guys. But the manner in which the solutions are being sought after are egregious at the least and horrifying at best. Does that make me hippie?
Absolutely, but I'll join you on the commune. It does seem interesting to me that number one, virtually all the discussion that's taken place in the last 24 hours has been going on in the absence of any real information. We've had information that's starting to come out, but a lot of the conversation began when we knew essentially nothing past the fact that a bunch of people had been shot. And I think it's fascinating.
There were about 4 hours of television with absolutely nobody knowing anything.
Which did not stop them from opining early and often. And I do think that it's interesting that while this is happening in California, we also have a political contretemps going on in Chicago regarding their mayor, who famously coined the phrase that you never let a good catastrophe go to waste. And we have seen people talk about the need for increased intrusion into the electronic lives of everyone, even though there's absolutely no evidence so far that the two shooters used any sort of obfuscation at all. They were doing everything, it seems, pretty much in the clear. This is one we're going to hear about for a long time, I'm sure. But, dear heavens, it's going to be making things interesting. And it's certainly going to be a topic, I think, in the presidential fracas. That's already been happening. So my question back to you, and I don't want to spend the whole show on this. We do have some other things to discuss. But again, Sarah, I will come back to you on this question. Given that I don't think anyone sitting around our virtual desk here is in favor of massive new surveillance regimes, what does it make sense to do? Is there anything, or is it just the new reality that we have to accept that every now and again someone is going to shoot up a bunch of people for political reasons? I mean, this is the U.S. We have someone shooting up a bunch of people pretty much daily somewhere. So from a purely practical standpoint, does this matter?
Well, I mean, I don't know that the solution for this is something that comes from the technology world, actually. I don't know that this is necessarily a problem that is in our realm to fix. I mean, I think that I could be wrong on that, but I think that these days so much always comes back to IT and to technology, and like, well, we just need another tool to fix this, and I don't know that I agree with that. I will say that I have a contact who is in the job of tracking ISIS, and I am working on doing a story and interviewing that person so that I can get more information about the methods being developed. So I hopefully in the new year we'll have more information about what is being done and what might be done. So we'll have more to add on that topic in a couple weeks, hopefully.
We will look forward to that. I know I'm going to be looking forward to that, absolutely. And Larry, I'll turn to you. You've been around this part of the world for a long time. Is there anything that we can do? Is there anything that people would accept that we could do to make it better?
If you take a technological solution, someone will come up with a workaround. I think social engineering is our only real hope on this, where you tend to honeypot someone who's either wants to, they do it already online, for heaven's sakes. How many child pornographers, Jared, got caught by an FBI agent pretending to be, 12 years old? That sort of approach actually weeds out some of the mal-do-wells and all that. But how do I put this? I wrote about the FBI's use of national security letters this week as well. And for the first time, we got a real live one that's 11 years old. And what kind of things they're doing with it. Just having a broad dragnet doesn't work, and this applies to NSL metadata collection as well. They don't have enough people on the earphones to be able to sift through the data they already have. Unless they've got Watson working on this thing, to try and connect all the dots. You see what I'm saying? They could have all the backdoors they want. They can decrypt all the messages they want. They still don't have a way to connect the dots in order to avoid some serious problems. Okay.
Well, I feel much cheerier now. I'm just going to sit in my closet with my supply of legally obtained firearms and wait for the entire world to go away. That seems to be the answer. But, you know, I think it's amazing that even in the face of this kind of thing, the world keeps turning. And in this week, it turned to another one of the things that we can count on. And that was Steve Ballmer saying something outrageous. And, you know, I think as long as we have that, we can hold on to a lot. In this case, Steve either was demonstrating tremendous insight into the business of Microsoft, or he was stomping through an epic public case of sour grapes. Because basically he said that everything that Satya Nadella is doing is wrong.
Is this the guy that let Microsoft miss mobile? Is this the same person that made the entire corporation fall asleep for a decade?
Well,
that would be the one.
That would be the one, yes. And I think it's interesting that you brought up mobile, because one of his complaints is about the mobile direction. You know, Microsoft is making it so that you can write a universal app. So you write once and it runs across all of their platforms. Steve says this is a crackpot idea, that what they need to be doing instead is allowing Android to run on Microsoft devices. Larry,
God, the security vector alone staggers me.
Well, I was going to turn to you. What do you think? Is Mr. Ballmer right on target, or is this classic Steve?
It would be classic Steve if we could see the flop sweep come off him as he was saying it. But, oh, you like that one, Sarah. Okay, you can use it. File off the serial numbers and just use it. I don't know why anybody's listening to a basketball team owner now. His track record is unequaled in American business as far as tanking an entire company. In so many ways, it's amazing. That would be sort of unbelievable coming out of anybody else's mouth. No, Microsoft cannot let Android run on its systems. It can't let iOS run on its systems. If anything is going to happen for Microsoft in mobility, they're going to have to be able to control the operating system enough to generate things like Cortana integration across everything they got. That, you know, it's something that is, God, who wants to run Android anyway for so many reasons? I mean, yes, it's free. Yes, it doesn't get updated damn near enough, but it really doesn't do much for anybody aside from the Chinese manufacturers. Have I ranted long enough?
That's a good one. I'm impressed so far. Well, Sarah, you've got a shining example to follow. What do you think about Mr. Ballmer and his approach to Microsoft's business?
Well, I agree that he should focus on the Clippers and worry about their sort of troubles, because they do have troubles, and I don't know. They've got issues that they need to sort out there in L.A. But that aside, because I really do care about basketball, I don't know. I feel like although I'm not an Android user, I certainly don't think that you can just can ignore Android. Android's actually a very has a pretty big market share. I don't think that you can ignore them entirely if you are if you're Microsoft. That is not a major player in mobile. If you intend to become a major player in mobile, that's not the kind of thing that you can just brush off and be like, they don't matter. But I think that if you are, but the universal apps strategy for a company like Microsoft seems to me to be a better idea than just one that, I don't know, that than one that just runs Android apps and sort of blows off everything else for Microsoft. It kind of, because I have to imagine that they're going after a different kind of, they're still going after a different kind of mobile user. Frankly, I'm not sure that either is a good plan, but Microsoft might have just missed the bus on this entirely.
Well, to me, one of the important things, and in this case, I'm going to agree largely with Larry. It seems to me that what we have now are three basic ecosystems. You have the Microsoft ecosystem, you have the Apple ecosystem, and then you have the Google ecosystem that encompasses both Google and Chrome and Android. And what these three big players are doing is trying to convince people to live within their ecosystem. And the main benefits of any of the product within that ecosystem accrue to the extent that you use all the products in the ecosystem. Trying to mix and match means that you lose out on a lot. So to me, what Satya Nadella is trying to do is set up Microsoft to have a compelling ecosystem for the enterprise. And I think he's done a lot of the right things with the cloud push and with the direction he's taking mobile, even though, as both of you have pointed out, Microsoft has left itself a steep hill to climb in mobile, due largely, it has to be said, to things that happened or didn't happen during Ballmer's time at the top of the company. So this is one where I think that we all get to enjoy this whiff of the Ballmer of old, but don't have to worry about Microsoft suddenly changing direction based on his comments.
But worldwide, because I just looked this up because I was curious. Apparently, in Q2, according to IDC, Android had 82.8% of the OS market share as far as smartphones go. And iOS had 13.9%, and Windows Phone had 2.6%. So I'm going
to
say.
And perhaps to show how that may not be the right question to ask, I believe I've seen 70% of mobile purchases are done under iOS.
You know, I think...
Can I say that again?
70%.
Also, and 57.1% of mobile and tablet operating system is Android. And Windows, again, is like a sliver.
Yeah,
I'm going to interrupt for 1 second just to say this the way I've heard it. So something like 70% of the online purchases that are made mobily are made from iOS devices.
Okay. Mobile purchases made from mobile, purchases online made from mobile devices. 70% of them are made from mobile devices. Is that what I just heard?
Yeah,
you say?
I think
okay.
So. I'm not sure of my source. If you want to go ask God and Google it, you can try. But I'm pretty sure that's what it was. There's something really disproportionate
about,
about the number of purchases made from Android versus iOS.
Well, all right, but how much does that matter if you're the maker of the hardware?
Well, what I'm saying is it matters to the people that want to make money off the hardware users. If you the hardware maker for Android is some anonymous Chinese factory. Apple may use the same Chinese factory, Foxconn, but they're within the Apple-controlled ecosystem. You know? Manufacture isn't the key anymore. It really hasn't been the key since the first Macs rolled off of the Fremont, California assembly line. I'm saying there is a disproportionate use of these devices.
Okay.
As far as e-commerce goes. And just saying
who's got the most income that they're spending. Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Well, we'll have to have
a church.
Not yet. And I'm afraid we've just about run out of time for you to do so. we might have to put together a special show coming up on the mobile question, because that's one, there are a lot of bits of nuance to that. It's easy to, this is an area where it is especially easy to pick and choose among the available statistics to prove pretty much any point
definitely.
You want.
Definitely.
And we see that happening a lot. So we may have to do a special episode on this in the future. Well, that pretty much does it for our time today. I want, before we go, to do a couple of things. First, I want to say I hope you get well soon to our other regular guest, Dave Wagner, who generally brings us the geek in. Dave is under the weather. We hope to have him back around the table next week. And also like to find out what each of my guests think are going to be the important stories for the coming week. Sarah, I'm going to go with you first. What do you think people are going to need to keep their eye on in the world of security for the coming week?
There's always something going on. But I'm actually working on a piece that is about some of the C-level jobs that might actually be stealing some of the CISO's thunder. And the other stuff I can't tell you about because it's all on embargo. So if I tell you about it, they'll have to kill me.
Well, we certainly don't want that. So we will just have to keep an eye on your writing at Dark Reading. And tell us how to find out when that important writing goes up. How can we follow you out in this social media jungle?
Well, obviously you can just go to darkreading.com or you can follow me on Twitter. You follow me on Twitter at Sarah Peters without an H, or follow Dark Reading at Dark Reading. It's pretty easy.
Outstanding. Well, thanks very much for taking time out of a busy schedule to be with us today.
My pleasure.
And Larry, how about you? What do you think folks should be watching for the coming week? What are you going to have your eye on?
There's a number of evolving stories. I personally like the Yahoo soap opera myself. I mean, I'm just sitting here aghast at what used to be one of the internet's leading portals. Speaking of Steve Ballmer, and watching them just not know what to do about it anymore. There's more than that, though. I mean, Toshiba's thinking about throwing away its PC business. You know, why do you want a PC anymore? You got a Mac. You got a Mac. Isaac Brad Pro. The electronics. Speaking of hardware manufacturers, there's going to be a lot of that kind of change happening, even in the mobile section. I mean, Samsung has to pay $500 million to Apple for its patent infringements on the iPhone. That's mind-boggling. I mean, you know, it's almost a disincentive for anyone to get into the hardware business anymore. I don't know. I mean, I've got lots of questions. This is traditionally a slow time of the year, and we'll have to see how it develops.
That we will, and I know you're going to have plenty to say about that. Tell us how we can follow you out in the jungle of the social media. How do we keep up with your daily musings out there?
Well, the NSA already does a good job for you, so just log into your NSA account and find out what I'm doing in real time. If you don't have one immediately available to you, you can use my name, Larry Loeb, on Twitter with this ampersand in front of it. I'm all over the place using that tag. I blast all sorts of things out about the articles that I write on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and G+. So you can find me there.
We will certainly look for you on all those places and follow you, because what you have to say is absolutely worth reading. As for me, I'm going to be looking at a number of things. I've got a great story coming up early next week on CyArk. If you're not aware, CyArk is the group that does very detailed digital mapping of World Heritage sites. So basically, if UNESCO has designated it as a World Heritage site, CyArk works to take a detailed digital map so that in event of natural or man-made disasters, we can look at what was. In some cases, teams have used that to recreate something that has been destroyed, and given what's going on around the world, their work is more critical than ever. I'm going to be looking at how they do it, how they make it all happen, and doing lots more, to be honest. Also have a great slideshow coming up on your holiday gift guide to Linux distributions. For all that and more, you can follow me on Twitter.
Do you have to wrap it in a red sock or a red hat?
Always the hat. But you can follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. My Periscope handle is the same. I'm also on LinkedIn as Curtis Franklin, and on Facebook. Well, for all of us here at Information Week Live, thanks for listening. I'm Kurt Franklin. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.